Welcome, thank you so much for coming to this first event in the 2019-20 season of Poetry Matters. Our title this evening is Wonder and Kindness, poetry of Stephanie Bolster and Susan Elmsley. It's my pleasure to introduce Sue Elmsley, and then Miranda will introduce Stephanie. Susan Elmsley's poems have appeared in many literary magazines and anthologies. She's the author of a prize-winning chapbook, When Your Body Takes to Trembling, printed by Cranberry Tree in 1996. Her first book, I, Nadia, and Other Poems, published by Brick Books in 2006, and won the Quebec Writers Federation A.M. Klein Poetry Prize. Her latest collection is entitled Museum of Kindness, published by Brick Books in 2017. It's a gripping book. It's moving, it's crafted, gives us sublime emotions, and gives us elegant forms. You don't notice any of the forms the first time through. You're sort of taken by the anguish and the miracle voiced in these wonderful poems. I urge you all to buy a copy. There's copies for sale today. So if you eat a grape, you're obliged to come up and buy a book of poetry as well. We'll welcome Sue Elmsley, first of all.
Thank you, and again, thank you to all of you for being here on behalf of Elaine McLaren, on behalf of me, Miranda Hickman, and Michael Nicholson, co-facilitators of Poetry Matters. Please, at any point, feel free to take some refreshment at the back. We have some goodies at the back. So Stephanie Bolster is a poet and editor who teaches at Concordia University. Her work includes White Stone, the Alice Poems, which won the Governor General's Literary Award for Poetry, and the Gerald Lampert Memorial Award. Her work also includes Two Bowls of Milk, Pavilion, and a page from The Wonders of Life on Earth. And Bolster's editorial work includes Ishtar Gate, Last and Selected Poems of Dinah Brebner, The Best Canadian Poetry in English, 2008, and then edited with others is Penned, Zoo Poems. And I want to mention something that, Stephanie, you might mention this evening. Your current project, Long Exposure, is a book-length poem, and it takes as a point of departure Robert Polidori's post-disaster photographs of New Orleans and Chernobyl. I don't know if you'll be pointing to that this evening, but thank you. So thank you to both of you for being here. I want to tell you something about another step that Poetry Matters is taking this season, because this season our focus will be on poetry readings. And we're taking as a key idea or challenge thinking about the nexus, possible points of connection between poetry and what we call these days bien-être, so healing or wellness, well-being. We're very aware that Apollo, god of poetry, is father to Asclepius, a divinity of medicine. And Poetry Matters as a group has been very impressed by the new work going on at McGill to address issues of health and wellness. So our work this year, through poetry readings and through other events, will focus on different ways of crossing the bridge, crossing conceptual bridges between poetry, work in poetry, and work on healing and wellness. And we're very aware in starting this that it's well not to oversimplify. We're trying to move past the more obvious ways of connecting the two areas to others. So how does one get from poetry, engagement with poetry, to states and various understandings of wellness? And both Stephanie and Sue have agreed to offer a few remarks on that this evening through their poetry. So far, I'll let you know where our thoughts are on this. We've been thinking a good deal about modes of attention associated with poetry, modes of deep, intent attention and reading associated with poetry, a kind of slow time associated with the experience of poetry often, and how these might relate to forms of well-being. I'll also welcome somebody who's agreed to be here this evening, who's been very involved in health and wellness at McGill, and that's Lina Di Genova, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly. And I'd like to welcome Lina, because she'll be offering some observations tonight from her perspective. Poetry Matters is partnering this year with the Student Wellness Hub, the Student Wellness Initiative at McGill that is newly formed as of a couple of years ago and had its formal launch this past summer. And we're also partnering with a group in the Faculty of Education, the Institute for Human Development and Well-being in the Faculty of Education at McGill. So please stay tuned for further news on those partnerships and events that we're forming this year in addition to the readings in poetry. And let me say something about Lina DeGenova's work. Lina is Director of Strategy, Assessment, and Evaluation in Student Services at McGill. As a researcher, she's focused extensively on the area of mental health. She has over 15 years' experience in organizational performance metrics, and she's a co-founder of the Best Practices Network in Canadian Higher Education, making a positive impact on student mental health. And Lina is a licensed organizational psychologist, and she's a change management practitioner. So thank you for being here this evening as well. So without further ado, let me turn things over to the poets, and we're trying out our tech this evening. We're new to tech in this way, in this space, so if anything isn't audible, please keep us posted during the reading, and we'll turn things over to you two.
Well, thank you, Eli. Thank you, Miranda. Thank you, all of you who have come. I was thinking about the role of poetry and wellness for me personally when I was a graduate student writing my dissertation. And my area is Canadian literature, and I worked on contemporary Canadian women's fiction, even though poetry is really my love. It was in the interest of a coverage model, you know, for being able to teach. And there were times, if you have writer's block or being overloaded with work demands, writing articles or that sort of thing, marking papers, I would go to the poetry stacks and read journals sort of indiscriminately. I would just pick something out and take it to the table, bound journals, often Canadian literature, but not always. And when I found a poem I liked, I would copy it out by hand and refuse to write where I got it from. Like, you know, we're very careful about keeping track of sources, but they were poems for me. They were like, I would allow myself an hour, sometimes 2 hours a day to do that. I know that seems like a lot, but it was very helpful. I'm going to read some poems today from different sections of Museum of Kindness, and I still feel like the writing of poetry is a form of guerrilla gardening for me in a hectic lifestyle where, I mean, we all have those lifestyles where really there's not time for something like this, but there's a necessity for it, and I've always felt a certain urgency about what poetry is and what it can do. And I'm of the belief that it actually does save people's lives, not in the same way that a Kevlar vest might, or a medication that you need, but in the way that you can be reconnected to yourself and to others when you have felt lost. So this poem is called Poetry. Only embroidery and cancer are slower, sometimes not even. The blending of punishment and reward. Can't pay someone to do it well. Russian ballet and break dance, waltz and lap dance, champagne and bathtub gin, lashing and balm. And I would like to sort of posthumously dedicate that to, I'm not posthumous, but in a way, let me get my language right. I'd like to dedicate that to my friend and poet Susan Briscoe, who was working on a book of poems when she got sick with cancer. And this one is called Material. You know, what is the subject that is suitable for poetry? Well, of course, anything. And what can poetry do for us? Sometimes I think when we're young, we might overestimate what it can do. For me, I must say, I must declare, people are more important than poems to me. But there was a time when poems were more important than people. This poem is an epigraph from Wisława Szymborska from her poem Possibilities. She says, "I prefer the absurdity of writing poems to the absurdity of not writing poems." And that's the Claire Kavanaugh and Stanislaw Branczak translation. "At least you got a poem out of it," we'd say, thin on irony, as though getting a poem out of it absolved you of stooping a married man, failing your comps, losing your rent at the slots. Now, years on, careworn, doesn't it seem quaint to be consoled by getting a poem out of it, whatever it is? Dividend of grief, one of the perks of pain, gifted with an endless supply of material, redemption only a roundel away. When there was a shooting at Dawson College, that kind of experience is so hard to talk about, even with people who've been through it, and maybe especially so, that it was quite a while before I was able to write more than one poem about it. And one of the poems that I wrote is called Unteachable Moment. It has an epigraph from the Odyssey, the Fitzgerald translation. "Woe to the innocent who hears that sound," referencing the sirens. In lockdown, I'd been desperate to hear sirens. Once outside, safe, they were too much. Paroxysmal, Dopplered, they blared past me, hurry, hurry, on the way to my daughter's daycare, and at home, in our living room, on the TV, looped footage, our near silence, punctured by the stifled lament of police cars, ambulances careening to the ER, converging on the scene I'd just escaped. My husband and I, slumped on the couch, unable to get out the oars, were watching our daughter playing on the floor. "That," she said, pointing at the screen. "Ambulance," I said. But she shook her head, still pointing, her fingers stirring the air. I turned it right down, but could still hear it. I told her, "That's a siren." Waited to see if she was satisfied with just the word, or if she'd press me for what the sound itself meant, this moment. I was queasy, watching my school on the news, as if learning who and how many could staunch the genre, as if the next, kept to himself, wasn't also taking cues, gearing up, shooting selfies, poised with his Glock, and again, on every channel, sirens will serenade kids filing from schools, some with their arms on the shoulders of the kid ahead, looking for all the world like anguished rowers. I got down on the floor. I'll read another of these poems in this series called Trigger Warning. This one is after James Hoke's book, Miscreants, in which he tries to reimagine what might have happened to a childhood friend had he not gone off on his own and been abducted and killed. So it takes that kind of clause, the conditional. If he had taken up guitar, played ping pong or ultimate frisbee, tried deep breathing, accepted human frailty, adopted a mutt at the SPCA, shoveled his neighbor's walk, did a year abroad. If there were more ways in than out, if he felt that someone was listening, maybe a boy on the beach after parasailing at Île Sainte-Marguerite, the scent of umbrella pines and eucalyptus in the air, taking sips from a can of Cronenberg, if his favorite aunt had been a police officer, if he'd had a favorite aunt, if his car had gotten a flat and he'd taken this as a sign to take a spiritual U.E., if he had smelled fear and been able to name it, if he could laugh at himself, if he'd read Dostoevsky, Ian McEwan, Tim O'Brien, if he'd preferred the Guggenheim and techno gadgets to guns, if he made a mean gulab jamun or tiramisu or quindim, if it was so simple it was beautiful, if he'd had a sibling with cystic fibrosis, a teacher from Trinidad, a chum who meddled in Taekwondo, a summer of love, a walk in the park, a hug around the neck, a Sudoku habit, if he had talked to his doctor or mother and tried meds, and planted some sub-zero roses, if he had been pulled over for unpaid tickets, bowed to cosmic irony, and vowed to give peace a chance, if he had not been born or were somehow reborn, if we could recognize him this turn, slip not time, help him to feel good in his skin when he begins this day and when he lays his head down to dream. This one is called There's Never Just One Trauma, the therapist says, and it was one of the scarier ones to write because I did experience PTSD after the shooting, not right away, and during, I was very, very calm, abnormally calm, but months later, I started to feel my body separate from my mind when I came in the building. And I was afraid to leave my house. And I got help, EMDR therapy. And this is, so there is a real therapeutic component to this. And poetry is not always therapy. In fact, as I was talking with Miranda, sometimes one likes to, you know, downplay that component completely because, of course, serious art, high art, has a different function than self-help books or, you know, therapy. So that has to do with backlash against the feminization of so-called confessional poetry to a certain degree. But anyway, here we go, big preamble. There is never just one trauma, the therapist says, and if you listen, you'll hear that it's a kind of palindrome. That is, there's a middle point, and after that, all the lines repeat in reverse. Fired, 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 that's why I'm here. Months following the shooting at my school, I fear I will be fired. Never mind that my performance is good. I've misfiled my students' names. I float through the corridors somewhere above my own jumpy prop. As I run for the bus, I envision my house swallowed by fire. Hats off to the mind's gymnastics, how it can juggle and riddle and pun, so that the discharging of the gun, the firearm, firing now months later, activates a fear in me to be fired, which is really fallout, cue to my big childhood trauma, the torching of our house by our tenant at night while we slept. Doctor moves a pencil back and forth, like the pendulum of a metronome, and my gaze follows it, tick-tock, tick-tock, redirecting eye movements as I revisit one of the doppelganger traumas to reprocess it. You, too, can try this at home by pressing the top of each knee like a cat kneading a cushion before a nap. You, too, can try this at home, pressing the top of each knee, one of the doppelganger traumas to reprocess it, redirecting eye movements as I revisit, and my gaze follows it, tick-tock, tick-tock, like the pendulum of a metronome. Doctor moves a pencil back and forth by our tenant at night while we slept. My big childhood trauma, the torching of our house, to be fired, which is really fallout, cue to firing now, months later, activates a fear in me so that the discharging of the gun, the firearm, how it can juggle and riddle and pun, hats off to the mind's gymnastics. As I run for the bus, I envision my house swallowed by fire. Somewhere above my own jumpy prop, I float through the corridors. I've misfired my students' names. Never mind that my performance is good at my school. I fear I will be fired. I'm here, months following the shooting. Fired, fired, fired. That's why. Okay. And this one. This one took a longer time to write because it overturned everything that I thought I knew about teaching. So when you can go through a threshold experience like that where you think, hey, I might actually die, okay. Going back and you just aren't the same. So that's what this is about. Teaching philosophy, which is something that teachers do, right? And they're teaching portfolios. You have to construct a teaching philosophy. So you could sort of do a before and after. This is mine now. After the shooting at my school, which was sometime after and sometime before shootings at other schools, I'd observe my students as they abstained from taking notes, slogged through an exam or zoned out, while I soft-shoed my way through tropes and figures. I began to see them as perhaps the flight attendant during the performance of the in-flight safety monologue regards the suits reading papers, row upon row of heads hooked up to gadgets, and lighting on one face, on an exhale, I'd say to myself, this is somebody's child. Nostalgic for the speedbird rigor that fueled my early years of teaching, now I also reckon its cost in missed connections, in the time lost, composing my final comments on papers, not collected, stowed in file drawers, where my mantra, be as precise as possible, whenever possible, fades away like contrails in the ether. I think, if I teach nothing else today, let me show compassion to somebody's child. And in case poetry may save as many lives as floor-level lighting and safety hatches, let me be as philosophical as the flight attendant, my near double in the sister city of work, as I cope with constraints of space and time, in a milieu fraught with risk, attending to the needs of people who want to get somewhere else, yet still might enjoy the flight. What, you know, writing this book, I thought a lot about what the worst is, what we think of as the worst. And I honestly, I don't think I've experienced the worst, but we say it colloquially. How was the drive? Oh, it was the worst. How, you know, how was the passing of your father? The worst. And I think of the worst as like this moving target. It never quite, it's always happiest in the future. And yet I think I see some people have gone through it. That's my idea of the worst. So I thought about it. What is the worst? And this is the last poem in the section, trigger warning, and it opens up into the next section, which is a kind of opening door into another kind of potential worst. So the worst has an epigraph by the Brothers Grimm. It's the end of Hansel and Gretel. Then was all care at an end, and they lived in great joy together. What you thought was the worst, what you thought you couldn't endure, you lived through, and something else became the worst, all at once or in increments. The worst telescopes, maybe happiest in the future, barely detectable, like a shadow on the lung, below the whorl and grain of ultrasound. We learn that hubris connects Sisyphus and Schlepp. In Greek mythology, we say nemesis. In therapy, we say lifestyle and rock bottom. An anagram for ruined is inured. The waxed doorknobs of semantics. How do we get a handle on the worst when it's a moving target, always beyond the baldly conceivable and unimaginable, beyond lynchings and postcards of lynchings? It must be that there are more worsts than ways to parse them. The personal and the collective, the local and the global. And the worst is where they overlap. I think of that bus in New Delhi and can't think. What pill blurs the mismatch between our need for meaning and our inability to find it? When what feels like the worst happens to us, I wish us an eye of oblivion that we can enter like a licked thread and somebody ties the knot. A pendulum swinging to and fro between boredom and pain is what Schopenhauer thought. What if the worst, rather than always receding like the mirage of water on the road ahead, is more like a threshold? So what we thought was the worst is only an opening. This is in praise of hospital cafeterias. It has an epigraph by Emily Dickinson, "What water is taught by thirst." Not exactly an oasis in the desert, but as you bide time before the biopsy or loosen your watch to let the news sink in, good to avail yourself of the $2.22 coffee and muffin combo, or fairly pulp-free and OJ and bagel. Benign beige plastic chair, dusty plant languishing on a ledge, a single bloom reaching toward the window's frosted glass. On another day, this plant is giving God the finger. The food service worker's skirt argues with her butt. Luck sounds like a word a baby might say, trying out her tongue. So what if you've forgotten the common names of trees? The taste of a carrot with the dirt just rubbed off. Which bird says, "You cheeseburger, 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 cheeseburger." There is ordinary comfort in wrapped straws. A lady is scraping a muffin paper with her teeth. So beautiful. For now, there is no bloom of blood in the syringe, magenta, a magician's scarf. Here you are, a hiatus before climbing an endless flight of unpainted stairs, or sitting at home, suffering the muzak of the incontinent faucet. Okay. A couple more. These are from now the section of the book called Threshold, in which I explore parenting and as well as parenting a child with health problems and special needs, like on the way to diagnosis, when you don't know what's wrong, but you know something is. And I thought of this section, as well as the whole manuscript, as sort of loosely reflective of a hero's journey. I have always thought that birthing a child is like a hero's journey, and the child's development and birth is the journey of a hero. And so there's moments that are threshold moments, being in the belly of a whale or, you know, at the nadir and all of that. So this is Threshold, about my son getting an MRI. It took two nurses and your dad to hold you down for the IV. The nurse with the needle plunged for a vein, which you'd scuppered in your rage. First one fist, then the other, your turbo cry shredding the scenery. And that one marathon howl. Nothing can ever be academic for me now at your feet. Nor for your dad, the heavy, who'll carry you into the Faraday cage, catch your head when the Nembutal drops anchor, lay you down like a wilted bouquet on the MRI bed. He'll sit vigil while you're in the whale's gut under a striped flannel. Double earplugs, pacifier, your protection from the runway din of magnets doing the bump, this sunless spell. From behind the observation glass, I let you go, too. Burlap and twine swaddle the shrub in winter. The word, dolor. In my mind's vault, I still hold you. We rise with each swell, dip with each trough, look to the far shore. And this is a nadir moment, called descent. My baby was still nursing, and I'd lean over the bed steel rails to give him the breast, let him twist his fingers in my hair until he slept, anchored by electrodes, gauze bonnet, fat snarl of wires twisting into a Bob the Builder backpack that housed the tracket box near the call switch. I could not leave the ward, though they urged me to. Go home, get a shower, change. At night, an infrared video captured our quiet ballet. I could not leave, could not leave. On the third day, I was sent down to the basement, to the abandoned locker room, past the heavy steel door that would not quite close. I stood under exposed ducts, frazzled fluorescent tubes in a ship's bilge. Whiff of mildew, occult drip. In the dim light, I found the one narrow shower stall. The slick edge of the torn plastic curtain pulled it back. No one to hear me. My baby lay in a bed flights up, electrodes pasted to his scalp, helmeted in gauze. I stripped, hung my milk-sour tracksuit and hospital towel on a hook, stepped over the lip onto a flattened shopping bag spread like a lily pad on the blackened grout, institutional green tiles, the first cold water, my baptism. I think, was that a half hour? Do I have a couple more minutes? Is it a half hour? Then I'm going to read, I think is the last poem here, one called Miracle. And do you know the poem Pied Beauty by Gerard Manley Hopkins? Because it's an intertext to a degree. Glory be to God for dappled things, for things of couple color, a brinded cow, right? The poem is a song of praise about diversity in nature and in created things, things created by people. But when I encountered it after this encounter, it opened up for me in a way it hadn't ever before, even though I'd read it probably hundreds of times. Like you look at a painting or a poster and all of a sudden you see something you didn't see. I love that about art. Okay, Miracle. Walled in by plexiglass, we warmed vinyl until the intercom garbled our son's name. The door hummed like a grade school teacher with a pitch pipe, and we pushed through into a white hallway lined with close-ups of daisies. The psychologist had an accent, East clinical or impending retirement. I couldn't quite place it. She asked our two-year-old to push a toy stroller to her door. Things went downhill from there. He dropped toys, wouldn't pick them up. You must make him, she insisted. Use hand-over-hand technique. We can't tell if he's willful or if our bidding to him is as the wind to the ocean floor. It's not okay to cross the street after the signal. Someone says goodbye, it's the time to reply, not long after, she averred. The long after poet in me hugged the mother in me, deflated by the psychologist's prediction of assisted living. You look sad, she said, less observation than sugared jeer. No, I said, swiping the emoticon for sandbagged from my face. I reached for the disability tax credit forms. She held out like cocktail napkins. My husband said, what I hope for him is that he'll be able to have a relationship, connect with someone. She had the look of a croupier raking in chips for the house. Barring a miracle, said the psychologist, he'll be a good candidate for a special needs school. You a psychologist or a psychic? Long after, in this poem, I can say that. In the office, though, beyond plexiglass and the mandatory umbrella check, I said goodbye, ran to my afternoon class, arriving dazed, rain splattered in my coat to teach the assigned poem, Pied Beauty. Reading Hopkins aloud to fresh, unworldly faces, this time, when I got to all things counter, original, spar, strange, the skin of my life caught in the teeth of the poem, and it sang through me. Thank you.